Hi, I'm Marianne Campbell. This is the fifth talk in a series of eight given by Al Stewart for the City Bible Forum. This week's topic is quite disturbing. Who can make sense of life when it's cruel and unjust? Join me as we listen to Al.
About 30 years ago, John Lennon wrote these very famous words. Imagine there's no heaven, it's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries, it isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. Imagine no possessions, I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger, a brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will live as one. A beautifully written song and haunting as you hear him sing it. What's he saying? Well, if we could just pull the plug on God, religion, any belief in sort of anything beyond the here and now, and then no countries and so on, and we could all just get on. Can you imagine it? I don't mean would you like it to happen? I mean, can you imagine it happening? Do you think it ever will? And if it isn't happening, why not? Why hasn't it happened? That idea of pulling the plug on God, if you like, or leaving the supernatural out, is a little bit like the starting point for Ecclesiastes. Although I think Mr. Lennon's song is written from the point of view of being an atheist, Ecclesiastes is not. What's the difference? Ecclesiastes is a book in the Old Testament written through the eyes of King Solomon. What Solomon does as he writes is to look at the world, and you see at the end of that little phrase there at the beginning of the book, under the sun. And what he means by that, as far as I can work out, is this. If God hadn't spoken to us, he's not an atheist, he believes that God is there, as almost everyone does intuitively. But if God hadn't spoken to us, if we didn't have a clear word from God, if we just had our common sense and our eyes to look at the world, how would we make sense of it? What does the world appear under the sun just as we see it? And what he asked the question about gain, it's like, what's the bottom line? What's left over? What's the surplus? Well, as Solomon comes to look at his world, he tells us right in the beginning of Ecclesiastes how the world appears under the sun. He says at the beginning of the book, 1 verse 2, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. Now what we've seen over the last, week 5, what we've seen over the last 4 weeks is that Solomon says the world appears meaningless, what's there left for all our work and so on, what's substantial, what lasts, and he sets out to look for something that gives meaning or purpose. And we've seen him look at pursuing pleasure and then wisdom, and then work, and then possessions. And all of those things, as we've seen, you can look at chapters 1 through to 4, all of those things just don't deliver in the end. They turn out to be insubstantial. They don't last. They're a vapour. Last week in chapter 3, we saw him look at the way that the seasons of life come and go, like a great pendulum that we can't control. The good times, the bad times, happy times, sad times, life and death. And he comes to the conclusion in the end that we can't control our lives. So at the end of chapter 3, we saw he said, at least try and enjoy life. That's the logical thing, isn't it? If you can't control it all, at least try and enjoy it. He says, so I saw that there is nothing better for a man than to enjoy his work, because that is his lot. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? In other words, make the most of life, enjoy it if you can. So what he does then, when we come this week, in chapter 4, he actually has a look out under the sun and says, what is life like under the sun? People treating each other with love and care and respect, a world that everyone shares and so on, the brotherhood of man, and no need for possessions and greed and hunger, and or is it very different to what John Lennon hoped the world would become? What's it like? There's a man called Paul Bellow who was a quote published in the New York Times. He says this, Socrates said, The unexamined life is not worth living. He says, my revision is, but the examined life makes you wish you were dead. Now, there's a man who's a little depressed about life but had a good hard look at it. You see, ladies and gentlemen, I put it to you that we live in a tiny window in human history of peace and prosperity and freedom. And most, the vast majority of people who have lived and do live on this planet don't share the same great benefits that we do. Let's have a look. You see, Solomon wrote this nearly 3,000 years ago. Of course, the world has progressed so much since then. Let's have a look at how out of date what it is that Solomon says, how much the world has progressed in 3,000 years. Let's see what he says about our world, or his world under the sun, and let us see if his world and our world are so very different. And he looks firstly under the sun and sees oppression in our world. Chapter 4, verses 1 to 3, he talks about oppression by powerful people being cruel and victimising the weak. He says, 4 verse 1, again I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power is on the side of their oppressors, and they have no comforter. And I declare that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been, who has not seen the evil that is done under the sun. Every night as you turn on the news, or every morning as you open the newspaper, there's an endless stream of people who are victims of power and oppression. If you're like me, in the end you have to screen it out because we just can't cope with the endless flow of people and violence and so on, the way people are treated. But every now and then there's something that just really hits me. This little girl hit me. This is Isatu Kagbo. She's 13 years old. I think the reason that I noticed this, she's the same age as my second daughter. Pretty little kid like my second daughter. Let me read you her story. Sierra Leone's 8-year civil war has settled into an uneasy peace, but it has left a cruel legacy. At the height of the country's chaos, this spring, rebel soldiers intensified an ugly ritual of amputations, seizing civilians and chopping off limbs. Human rights groups estimate that thousands have been maimed in this fashion. Isatu Kagbo is 13 years old, one of 7 children of her father, who's a farmer. The rebels came to our house at around 4 in the afternoon. There were 2 of them, a man about the same age as my father and a child soldier carrying an axe. The adults were begging and the children were crying. They put my hands on the ground and cut them off quickly, the left first. I didn't feel anything, or just something like a sting. Everything went dark and I fell to the ground. After a while I got up and walked a little way, but then I blacked out again and fell over. I don't know what happened to the other people. I had no idea why they did it to me. I want to go back to school. I haven't been back since this happened, but how can I write? I can't do anything except eat and drink water from a cup. Sometimes I follow my father into the forest when he cuts wood to sell in the truck park. I used to wash my clothes and cook, but now I can't do those things. I play with my younger sisters, chasing them and wrestling. I still do that. Her father says, any time she goes somewhere with us, I want to cry because they have destroyed her looks, he says. Isatu went to the Handicap International's clinic in Freetown and got a leather strap to help her hold a spoon on the end of her right arm. She smiles as she shows it off. Before, I used to eat by holding the spoon between my arms, she says. And what is it that Solomon says as he looks at our world and grieves? He says, notice in verse 1, and they have no comforter. Power is on the side of the oppressors, and they have no comforter. And he says, it's better to have never been born than to live in pain and fear. And it's not just in chapter 4 he talks about power and so on. There's economic oppression as well. I want to look today with you, at chapters 4 through to 7. There's so much material in there, we'd be here all day. I'm just going to have to pick and choose a few things to show you, to give you the feel of what the chapters are about. He talks about economic oppression as well. If you see the poor oppressed in a district and justice and rights denied, do not be surprised at such things, for one official is eyed by a higher one, and over them both are others higher still. The increase of the land is taken by all, and the king himself profits from the fields. That is, people use their power to line their own pockets, and it's always been the same. I picked up a copy of the Women's Weekly one day. I can't remember where I picked it up, someone's place. It's an article on totalitarian dictators. And you think, why is that in the Women's Weekly? Well, it's on their wives. Two of them, Imelda Marcos and Elena Corcescu, who was Nicolae Ceausescu's wife, the former ruler of communist Romania. who ended up being executed. Both of them were shot, I think it was at the end of the 80s. But listen to what she did in terms of taking advantage of the country and so on. Eleanor, the hatchet-faced wife of Nicolae Ceaușescu, the late and unlamented ruler of communist Romania. To understand Eleanor's grandiosity, it is necessary to visit the palace which she and Nicolae built for themselves in Romania's impoverished capital city, Bucharest. The House of the Republic, as the pile is known, is the second largest building on earth after the Pentagon, a towering, multifaceted, Stalinist-inspired concrete monstrosity that took 15,000 men 5 years of back-breaking toil to construct. The main hall in which the Ceaușescus would hold receptions was the size of a soccer pitch, with a gold-leaf ceiling and soaring hand-carved columns of Italian marble, and a 5-ton chandelier hung overhead. And not only did they commit the crime of theft, they committed the crime of bad taste on a huge scale. And it's not just those who are totalitarian. I heard recently of one wealthy businessman who immediately on the Bali bombing got on a plane and flew to Bali. And why? Not to help anyone, but because he thought the prices and value of tourist resorts, etc., in Bali would plummet and he might have been able to pick up a bargain. It happens. People exploit others economically. He goes on to say, well, what's our world like? He talks about emptiness in our world in 4 verse 4, envy. He said, and I saw that all labour and all achievement springs from man's envy of his neighbour. This too is meaningless and a chasing after the wind. Envy, is that a problem? Yes, it is. Have you ever wondered why the greatest secret we keep from other people in the workplace is how much we are paid? Why don't we actually just put our salaries on our security tags? You know, Alan Stewart, whatever it is. And we could all walk around with our salaries on our tags, couldn't we? No, we couldn't. Because envy is a problem. We'd either be envied or we'd envy other people. And on it goes. Greed tears our world apart. He talks about under the sun being characterised by loneliness. You may remember in chapter 2 we talked about the futility of earning all of this money and accumulating great possessions just to pass them on to someone in your family who hasn't worked for them. He says, under the sun there's something even worse than that. Again, I saw something meaningless under the sun. There was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. For whom am I toiling, he asked, and why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless, a miserable business. And that is, the worst thing than working to leave it to someone who hasn't worked for it is having no one to leave it to at all. He goes on in chapter 6 to talk about a lack of joy. How terrible it is to have a whole lot of money and to have accumulated all of this material possessions and to not be able to enjoy it. I've seen another evil under the sun, and it weighs heavily on men. God gives a man wealth, possessions and honour so that he lacks nothing his heart desires, but God does not enable him to enjoy them, and a stranger enjoys them instead. This is meaningless and a grievous evil. It's a great irony that one of the articles I found in researching this talk says that middle-class Australia is becoming like that. We're told in Sydney Morning Herald, Australians have never been richer, says a new study, yet the majority of middle-income households believe that they are doing it tough. At a time of unprecedented abundance, most Australians think they cannot afford to buy everything they need, and most say they spend their entire income on basic necessities of life. It goes on to say that the average household income in Australia now is 3 times what it was in the 50s, and yet most people think they haven't got enough money and they can't really enjoy it. It says, Australian families enjoyed a real income 3 times higher than in the 1950s and are now very comfortable. However, influenced by television lifestyle programs and conspicuous consumption of the rich, ordinary Australians aspire to a standard of living well beyond their means. Increasing numbers were in the grip of luxury fever, as it's called. So we're wealthy, wealthy, but we can't enjoy it. He goes on to talk about changing our world. And essentially, in 4 verse 13, he says, politics is fickle. Better a poor but wise youth than an old but foolish king who no longer knows how to take warning. The youth may have come from prison to kingship, or he may have been born into poverty within his kingdom. I saw that all who lived and walked under the sun followed the youth, the king's successor. There was no end to all the people who were before them, but those who came later were not pleased with the successor. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. It's a little hard to work out exactly what he's referring to. It almost fits King David and King Saul, the father and then the first king, his father, the first king of Israel, it could be. But what he's saying is politics is a fickle business. And the crowds love you one day and hate you the next, and you can even become disillusioned with a young politician who makes a mistake. And that's been known to happen. Here's the thing. He goes on to say, nothing ever changes. Whatever exists has already been named, and what man has been known. No man can contend with one who is stronger than he. The more the words, the less the meaning, and how does that profit anyone? But who knows what is good for a man in life during the few and meaningless days he passes through like a shadow? Who can tell him what will happen under the sun after he's gone? I think he's saying nothing changes. Everything's the same. Our world runs on oppression and greed. Now, is that still the same? That's what Solomon's saying all those years ago. Capitalism concentrates more and more wealth in the hands of fewer and fewer people. In the United States, in 1970, the top 1% of rich people owned 13% of the wealth. In 1995, the top 1% owned 38% of the wealth. Fewer and fewer people, more and more wealth. So maybe the socialists have the answer. The World Socialist website says, if you look in the middle there, several reports issued in Australia over the past 2 months have pointed to a continuing gulf between the richest and the poorest households. And then in the article it goes on to say that the top 20% of households are 40 times richer than the bottom 20%. Huge difference. Well, maybe the answer is if we could just get rid of the elites. So I went to the Socialist Alliance website. And what do they say? Well, the Socialist Alliance is an anti-capitalist party. We stand for socialism, democratic ownership and management of the social wealth. We believe that society based on satisfying human need can be created, but only by taking power from the elites who now rule. So if we could just set up a society where the workers took control and there were no elites and everyone shared everything, then there wouldn't be any problems, would there? Just like we did in, just like happened in Russia and China and Cuba and North Korea, and where there's no elite rulers who push people around. And what's the answer? Well, maybe the answer is the Live 8 concerts and, pushing people into, what was the word again? Make poverty history. Just after the Live 8 concerts at the beginning of the year, a man called Alan Kohler, who's a journalist for the ABC, wrote this article about Make Poverty History. Let me just read it to you. It's disturbing. He says, well, good on Sir Bob Geldof for organising an excellent concert yesterday. Then he talks about getting Pink Floyd back together and how good that was. But the real purpose of the Live Aid concerts, persuading the G8 nations to double aid to Africa, cancel its debts and open up trade, while well-meaning and hard to argue with, is in my view probably useless. 100,000 Africans own just under $1 trillion or $1,000 billion in wealth, while 300 million live on less than $1.50 a day. The problem with Africa is not a shortage of aid or resources or a lack of trade opportunities, but grand larceny. The continent is being openly looted by its elite. That's what's causing the poverty. In Kenya, the 2005 budget, for example, allocates $15 million for a new fleet of Mercedes for the government. Three quarters of Swaziland's aid, according to Spectator magazine, goes on King Mwatsi's parties, picnics and cars. And when Britain increased aid to Mwali, the government celebrated by buying 39 top new S-Class Mercedes-Benz and so on. All over Africa, people are oppressed and robbed. More aid and debt cancellation will entrench the elite. While European and America should definitely lower their trade barriers, that's not the problem with Africa. There's plenty of trade in food. So Bob tells us we should forget about the corruption thing, but in my opinion, that's all that matters. The only way out of poverty is to have a functioning democracy with property rights and jail for thieves. Now, at the same time, the average Australian household, this isn't the average Australian individual, the average Australian household gives less than a dollar a day to all forms of charitable giving. Less than a dollar a day. Less than 58 cents in every $100 that a household earns. We spend more on our pets than we do on foreign aid. Australia gives 1.2% of our GDP away. 1%. So what's the answer? We have two plagues in our world, hunger and obesity. How do you make sense of that? It's like what Solomon says back in 1 verse 15, what is twisted cannot be straightened, What is lacking cannot be counted. Under the sun, who can make sense of that? Half the world dies of obesity, the other half dies of hunger. How? And so we come back to imagining what the world might be like. Do you remember at the end of the Atlanta Olympics, Stevie Wonder sang the song Imagine? He sang the song Imagine about the brotherhood of man and so on at the celebration of the Olympics, which is all about the future of humanity and the great things we can do together and the brotherhood of humanity and so on. And as I watched it, it struck me there was a certain irony about him singing this at the end of an Olympics in a stadium full of 80,000 people who had, well, the spectators had been through metal detectors to stop violence, the athletes had all been drug tested to stop cheating, and the officials had all had their bank accounts checked to stop greed and corruption. I love the sporting endeavour, but the Olympics doesn't quite deliver what it says. And of course, the final sign-off on the Imagine song, what I think of when I hear it, is Mark Chapman. Does anyone know who Mark Chapman is? He's the man who shot John Lennon in 1980. And he's just had his third attempt at parole turned down. Imagine? I can't imagine it. I'm not saying I don't want it to happen. I'm just saying I don't think it will. Now, Solomon isn't a complete, forgive the expression, complete kind of misery guts. What he does go through here, I hope you might go away and read chapters 4 through to 7 yourself. There's just too much in it for me to go through verse by verse. What he does say is, though, that some things are better. You know, under the sun, well, at least let's try and make the most of it. Some things are better. For example, contentment. 4 verse 6, he says, better one handful with, you know, it's in the context of envy and greed, better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing the wind. Be content with one handful. Why ruin your life to try and get two? Except just a little less. Another thing that's better is companionship. Two are better than one because they have a good return on their work for working together. If one falls down, his friend can help him up. Pity the man who falls and has no one to help him. Also, if two lay down together, they'll keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? It's in the day of before electric blankets. Perhaps that's one thing that's changed. Though one may be overpowered, two may defend themselves, a cord of three strands is not quickly broken. What he means is multiple strands plait something together, more than one person, it's strong. Also, one thing that's better, well, I actually put this in just because it's a little light-hearted in the middle of today, it won't hurt, will it? It's better to live in the present and not in the past. So 7 verse 10, he says, do not say, why were the old days better than these? For it is not wise to ask such questions. I think when I see that, I think of the cleverest piece of graffiti I've ever seen, which was in a toilet block in Byron Bay. And it said, nostalgia ain't what it used to be. Don't live in the past. He goes on to say, though, there's something better, and that is in chapter 5, at least try and enjoy life. So, 5 verse 18. Then I realised that it is good and proper for a man to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his toilsome labour under the sun during the few days of life God has given him, for this is his lot. Moreover, when God gives any man wealth and possessions and enables him to enjoy them, to accept his lot and be happy in his work, this is a gift of God. If you can enjoy life, the gift of God. And notice what he's saying is, if you want to enjoy life, verse 20, don't think too much about it. He seldom reflects on the days of his life, because God keeps him occupied with gladness of heart. If you can enjoy life, it's kind of, I think he's saying, well, it's a kind of a shallow hedonism, but at least it's something. But there is something that's better than that. Something that's better than a party. And it's a very strange thing for him to say. 7 verse 2, what's better than a party? He says, it is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. For death is the destiny of every man, and the living should take this to heart. What he's saying is, what's better than kind of the shallow hedonism of a feast or a party is to go to a funeral. Why? Because a funeral confronts us with our own mortality and makes us think. What is life all about? Why is our world like it is? To make us reflect. And I think today what Solomon pushes us to reflect on is, where do all these problems in our world come from? They're kind of, there's personal and there's global. You know, why is it that soccer parents fight on sidelines? Why? Or why is it that one nation has to invade another? Why is it that we can create more and more and more wealth, and at the same time there's more and more and more poverty? Half the world in hunger, half the world in obesity. Why is it that socialism is so inefficient? And why is it that capitalism is so heartless? Why is it that we can't live up to even our own moral standards? Jesus taught about this. Let me just leave Ecclesiastes for a moment. Jesus actually speaks to us from God. And what Jesus says in Mark chapter 7, he addresses the problem. What's the problem with our world? Well, he puts his finger right on it. It's in the context of what makes you acceptable to God. And there was a debate going on at the time about, did you have to wash yourself in a ritual way? Did you have to be careful what you ate, that you couldn't eat pork or you couldn't eat meat or whatever it was? And Jesus says, no, 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 it's none of those things that make you unacceptable to God or make you unclean is the word. What is it that's, what's the problem? What makes people unacceptable to God? It's not food. I'll cut to the chase. Jesus said, he went on, it's what comes out of a man that makes him unclean. It's what comes out of us that makes us unacceptable to God. He says, for from within, out of men's hearts, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and make a man unclean. What's Jesus saying? You know, why is it that 3,000 years of progress and we haven't progressed? What's the problem with our planet, our world? The problem with our world is us. And the problem with us is our hearts. And from our hearts come things that are evil. We need a heart transplant. We need to be changed. We need to be forgiven. We need to know our Creator. And that is why Jesus came. That's Jesus' mission, to actually change those hearts to win forgiveness for us. Now, how does it all work? Well, we're coming to it. It's 3 more weeks in Ecclesiastes. We get to the answer. Or if you want to jump ahead, you can always read a gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. What is it that Jesus teaches? He says, what's the problem? Us, our hearts. That's the problem with the world.